You're listening to Crossing the Line, a weekly podcast dedicated to giving voice to the voiceless in occupied Palestine. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This week on Crossing the Line.
And I think it would be something very powerful if people did what they did around the South African case, which is to say there's a gap between the Olympic ideal and how Israel is treating Gaza, how it's treating the Palestinian people. And I think that would be an important thing to point out. Now, obviously, a lot of people don't want to get involved in that sticky wicket. But these are the moments, as they say, that try men's souls. And I think it would be worthwhile because it would start a discussion that really does need to happen.
The games of the 29th Olympiad kicked off on 8-8-08 in Beijing, China. Amongst the participating countries is Israel, who, although they claim to be the only democracy in the Middle East, have no Arab or Palestinian representation. Sports writer, activist, and author Dave Zirin will join us to speak about the Beijing Games, sports and politics, and whether or not Israel should be banned from international competition. Also this week, last summer, a group called the Palestine Media Collective produced a parody of the Vancouver Sun. 6 months later, Mordecai Brinberg was charged with producing the parody and committing a commercial violation of trademark. We'll hear an interview conducted by Jane Williams of the Red Eye Collective with Brian Campbell of the Seriously Free Speech Committee about the case. And finally,
I think what's happening is what's consistent with what's been happening for a very long time, which is that Israel, for quote-unquote security reasons, is able to do pretty much whatever it wants. And, you know, the security reasons that were given to the U.S., to U.S. officials, whatever they might have been. Of course, they're not shared with anybody else. They're not necessarily legitimized with any actual foundation of reality. And this is the way that Israel operates and has been allowed to operate given our policies of unconditional support.
Three Fulbright scholars from Gaza have been told by the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem that they will not be allowed to enter the United States after the consulate was informed of new information regarding the students from the Israeli military. Former Fulbright scholar, activist and author Anna Baltzer will join us to talk about the decision. All that and more coming up. But first, the news from Palestine.
This week in Palestine, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for August 9th through 15th, 2008. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert offered new ideas for a solution between Palestinians and the Israelis. Moreover, as Palestinian ceasefire with Israel enters its eighth week, the Israeli army has cleared the soldiers who killed Reuters cameraman. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. We begin our weekly report with recent non-violent actions in the West Bank. IMEMC's Rola Shahwan has the details.
On Friday, IMEMC's correspondents reported that a group of peace activists, including internationals and local villagers, marched in a nonviolent protest against the wall at Nilain village. After the Friday prayer was over, the protesters marched in a nonviolent protest against the illegal wall being built on the village lands and against the illegal closures and killings of Palestinians. A large number of Israeli troops halted the protest and banned the protesters from heading towards the wall. The Israeli army soldiers surrounded the protesters and attacked them, injuring seven, two suffered severe head injuries from rubber-coated steel bullets fired by soldiers, and dozens suffered from CS gas inhalation. All wounded protesters were taken to local hospitals for treatment. The Israeli army dispersed the weekly nonviolent protest in Bir'ain village, north of Ramallah, on Friday midday with gas, guns, and grenades. After the weekly Friday prayer, a group of 300 internationals and peace activists marched in solidarity with the people of Bir'ain village. The protesters were also demonstrating against the Israeli killings of local civilians and the illegal closures and confiscations of lands and property. The protesters were also demonstrating against the Israeli killings of local civilians and illegal closures and confiscations of lands and property. The protesters walked towards the wall with the intention of reaching their lands behind it. Israeli troops attacked the protesters by shooting CS gas canisters, rubber-coated steel bullets, and concussion grenades at them. Dozens of civilians were reported suffering the effects of gas inhalation. Israeli troops also threw manure and chemical water at the protesters. A group of 50 internationals, peace activists, and nonviolent protesters marched in protest against the illegal wall on Friday midday at Al-Khadr village located near Bethlehem. IMEMC's correspondents reported that the protest took place after the Friday prayer at the village. A group of 50 nonviolent demonstrators marched in protest against the apartheid wall being built on the village lands. Also on Friday, international action groups joined local villagers at Salamona in nonviolent protest against the building of separation walls. Close to 100 of the peaceful protesters from Italy, France, Israel, and the United States were kept from crossing the road by a fence of barbed wire. Israeli soldiers had strung across the road to prevent passing. For IMEMC.org, this is Rula Shahman.
This week, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was reported by Israeli media sources as offering new ideas for a solution between Israelis and Palestinians, as talks over the captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit are making no progress. IMEMC's Sophie Reed has the details.
Israeli media reports revealed this week that the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has offered new ideas for a peaceful solution between Palestinians and Israelis that include creating a Palestinian state on 93% of the West Bank lands and allowing the return of 20,000 Palestinian refugees on a yearly basis over 10 years. Ehud Olmert would not engage in the problem of Palestinian refugees displaced by Israel in 1948. The Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas's spokesman, rejected the statehood offer, branding it inconsistent with the Palestinian demands and international legitimacy resolutions pertaining to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. The Olmert proposal, according to the Haaretz newspaper, includes a Palestinian state on 93% of the West Bank, a 7% shortage to be compensated with lands in the Israeli Negev desert. Israel, in return, would keep major settlement blocks. Also, safe passage would connect the West Bank with the Gaza Strip, with Palestinians moving freely between the two parts of the occupied Palestinian territories. Israeli Foreign Minister Tzvi Lipni, a candidate to replace Olmert after he leaves office, objected to the proposal, saying she would work against it. Washington, which supervises Palestinian-Israeli talks since November 2007's Annapolis summit, will dispatch Secretary Condoleezza Rice next week to soften obstacles for the best of an acceptable solution for both parties. The United States has been attempting to reach a two-state solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict by the end of 2008. In the meantime, talks over the captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who the ruling Hamas party in Gaza still holds, have made no progress since Hamas and Israel agreed to an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire deal in June 19, 2008. During talks in Cairo on Thursday, Chief of Egyptian Intelligence Omar Suleiman told his Israeli counterpart Amos Gilad that Israel and Hamas should reach the resolution of the Shalit case in no later than 3 months. On the ground, Hamas has moved masses towards the Rafah crossing terminal in southern Gaza in protest of the terminal closure by Egypt since June 14, 2007. Deputy Speaker of the Hamas-dominated parliament in Gaza blamed the Egyptian leadership for what he considered suffering of the Gaza population. Mr. President, the people of Gaza are starving as Gaza's patients die one after another slowly. We appeal to the Arab States League to take its real role. We appeal to the Arab parliaments. We appeal to human rights groups. We appeal to the Organization of Islamic Conference. We appeal to Mr. Ban Ki-moon to relieve the people of Gaza. The Hamas's rally and protests emanate from the continued Israeli blockade of Gaza, despite the ceasefire deal, which Cairo brokered 2 months ago. Hamas's leader told reporters on Sunday that Israel only allows 60 trucks of commodities out of 450 trucks on a daily basis, as Israel closes the border crossings frequently since the deal has been concluded. On the other hand, Israel has recently warned of a large military offensive in the coastal region if the homemade shells fire continue from Gaza onto Israel. Amidst such a situation, media reports hinted at the possibility of bringing in Arab forces into the Gaza Strip to rein in the situation and rearrange the Palestinian internal politics. Egyptian mediators called this week for a meeting of Palestinian faction representatives in Cairo to discuss Palestinian national unity, which has stalled since Hamas took over Gaza and Fatah was ejected from the Strip in 2007, in June. Mohammed al-Baba, a political leader for the Popular Resistance Committees, a principal Gaza-based faction that holds soldier Shalit, told the IMEMC that his party believes that the ties with Egypt are solid enough, welcoming any Egyptian role. However, al-Baba said that any security or military force would be dealt with as the occupation is installed to implement Israeli or American agendas. This is Sophia Reed reporting for the IMEMC.
As the Palestinian ceasefire with Israel enters its eighth week, the Israeli army has cleared the soldiers who killed Reuters cameraman Fadl Shana'a. This and more from IMEMC's Rami Al-Migari in Gaza.
The Israeli military justice system exempted the soldiers who killed Fadl Shana'a, a Reuters cameraman, Al-Juhr al-Dik, in the central Gaza Strip on April 16, 2008. The Israeli military advocate general Avihai Mendelbel claimed that an Israeli tanky crew who killed Shana'a and a number of other unarmed civilians, including children, acted properly and will not face any legal action. The Palestinian Information Center reported on Sunday that the three residents were hospitalized after suffocating under the rubble of a collapsed tunnel in Rafah, in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, and Egypt. Seven residents are still missing. The three wounded residents are currently in a stable condition after receiving the needed medical attention. They were located on Saturday night. The tunnel collapsed Saturday evening. On Wednesday, the Israeli government announced that it will reopen four crossing points with the Gaza Strip, including the Kerem Shalom border crossing. This will be the first time that the Kerem Shalom crossing will be open in 4 months since an attack on the checkpoint, which injured 13 Israeli soldiers. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak ordered the borders closed on Tuesday in response to a homemade Palestinian shell that landed in an Israeli town bordering Gaza. Israeli forces have continued to close all border crossings to the Gaza Strip for more than 2 years. The Israeli siege of Gaza, which has been tightened since June 2007, has had a disastrous impact on the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip and has violated the human, economic, and social rights of the approximately 1.5 million Palestinian civilians. The rights to appropriate living conditions, health and education have been utterly ignored. The siege has paralyzed the Gazan economy. Furthermore, severe restrictions have been imposed on the movement of Palestinian civilian population. The siege imposed on the Gaza Strip has severely impacted the flow of food, medical supplies, and other necessities such as fuel, construction materials, and raw materials for various economic sectors. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
This week, Israeli forces conducted 26 invasions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank. During those invasions, Israeli forces kidnapped 33 Palestinian civilians, including 10 children. In addition, Israeli troops positioned at checkpoints throughout the West Bank abducted at least 3 Palestinian civilians. IMEMC's Robert Shaver has the details.
On Tuesday, a group of Israeli settlers attacked houses and a mosque in Hebron and attempted to set the mosque on fire. Settlers attacked both local civilians and international peace activists inside the mosque and showered them with garbage. Eyewitnesses reported that the settlers climbed onto the roof of the mosque and attempted to set it on fire. They also harassed civilians and forcibly grabbed video cameras from international photographers present at the attack. On Wednesday, a group of Israeli settlers attacked the West Bank city of Hebron, wounding a Palestinian child in the head. He was taken to a local hospital. On Wednesday, the Israeli army invaded Dehesha refugee camp south of Bethlehem and started firing at random, injuring an unarmed Palestinian boy with shrapnel from a bullet. Medical sources reported that the boy was transferred to a local hospital and that he is suffering from a moderate injury. Meanwhile, Israeli bulldozers demolished 3 houses in Jerusalem. Eyewitnesses said that the bulldozers demolished the houses immediately, preventing family members from rescuing any of their belongings before the houses were destroyed. The Israeli army justifies the demolition by claiming that the houses were built without the needed permission. However, since Israel occupied Jerusalem in 1967, it has rarely given its Palestinian residents any form of documentation for their land or homes or permission to build. On Thursday, the Israeli army invaded Dehesha refugee camp in the West Bank city of Bethlehem. Eyewitnesses reported that a large Israeli army force entered the camp and laid down heavy fire at random, injuring 2 civilians. The Israeli army took the 2 wounded civilians to an unknown destination. Israeli forces have continued to impose severe restrictions on the movement of Palestinian civilians throughout the West Bank. Thousands of Palestinian civilians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have been denied access to Jerusalem. Israeli forces have established many checkpoints around and inside the city. Restrictions of the movement of Palestinian civilians often escalates on Fridays to prevent them from praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israeli forces often assault Palestinian civilians who attempt to bypass the checkpoints and enter the city. For IMEMC.org, this is Robert Shaver.
And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check out our website, www.imemc.org. Thanks for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and Hussam Kassis.
In Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. The games of the 29th Olympiad kicked off in Beijing, China, on 8-8-08 at exactly 8:08 p.m. Over 10,000 athletes will compete in over 300 events in 28 different sports. This year's games, like so many before, have already been marred by controversy from human rights activists who have called on heads of state to boycott the games due to China's human rights record against its own people and its occupation of Tibet. And although some world leaders find China's suppression of the media, the jailing of political dissenters, and the religious intolerance of the Falun Gong disturbing, most attended the opening ceremonies. One of these participating in this year's games is Israel, which brought along 44 athletes. Although there are about 10,000 Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, none are amongst those that will be participating in any events. As Israeli swimmers prepare to compete against such notables like Dara Torres and Michael Phelps, Palestinians in Hebron are wondering if the water in their cisterns will be poisoned or shot at by the radical settlers living in the Old City. As Israeli track and field participants train to run in the most polluted air in the world, Palestinian children in the village of Nilayin, who are staging an ongoing nonviolent protest against the wall, try to run away from Israeli tear gas. Calls have been mounting for a boycott and divestment of companies that do business with Israel in order to further the occupation. Our guest today has been one of those that have added his voice to the throng. Dave Zirin is an award-winning sports writer who writes frequently for The Nation magazine, hosts a website, edgeofsports.com, and co-hosts a radio show called Edge of Sports Radio. In addition, he is the author of several books, including What's My Name Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States, Welcome to the Terror Dome, The Pain, Politics, and Promise of Sports, and the forthcoming A People's History of Sports in the United States. Dave, talk about this year's Olympics and the controversy of having them in China. In particular, you've noted in previous interviews that this was the Olympics that the West really wanted.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason that George W. Bush is the first sitting U.S. president to attend a games on foreign soil. I mean, there's a reason why the games are in Beijing in the first place. There's a reason why Western companies, as Naomi Klein has reported, have provided a lot of the security and surveillance technology for the games, including 300,000 closed-circuit cameras. And there's also a reason that China has spent $42 billion on the games. It's because they're in a mutual dance right now, where China wants the respect that it feels it's owed as a global economic superpower, and the West wants to make China palatable as well, because China has basically become the banker of the West, underwriting its wars, its occupations, and its very currency.
Dave, the Olympics are always presented to a country as a great way to showcase the nation and present better opportunities for all economically, but you've argued that this is not the case. Could you talk a little bit more about
that? The opposite, yeah. I think when the Olympics come to a given city, it usually is a corporate feeding frenzy. It usually does help a sector of the service economy. But for the community as a whole, it's a disaster. It means a serious crackdown on police powers. It means usually a massive displacement of people to make way for Olympic facilities, usually poor people who live in subsidized housing. And in the Beijing Games, I mean, they're talking about some estimates, 1.5 million to 2 million people have been displaced to make their way for the Games. And in addition, people have been imprisoned. People who have relatives from Tibet who work as bartenders in the theater district of Beijing are finding themselves out of work or deported. I mean, it's a nightmare. And one of the things it's meant, ironically, remember when I said that the service economy is one of the few things that benefit, that the service economy is actually taking a bit of a bath in Beijing, according to one report I read, because there's so many thousands of fewer foreign visitors than they imagined, because people have been really turned off and turned away by the specter of repression.
And Dave, the athletes have been told that they're there to compete and not to offer up opinions regarding China's human rights record or the occupation of Tibet. But about 40 athletes basically defied this order and signed an open letter. Can you talk about this letter and in particular some of the prominent athletes that signed it, in particular such people such as U.S. track and field star Dee Dee Trotter?
Well, it's a fascinating letter because it's signed by Dee Dee Trotter. It's also signed by Daria Robles, who is a Cuban track star. And so this idea that you have a Cuban athlete and a U.S. athlete both signing the same letter, calling for human rights, but also calling for an end of China's use of the death penalty. And China is really second to only one country in its use of the death penalty. That country is the United States. So this is something that I find very fascinating and very interesting. And the fact that I can't imagine that either Raul Castro or George W. Bush is pleased about this letter, but it says something about athletes and their ability to think independently, which a lot of people don't really think of athletes as being able to do.
Before the Israeli Olympic team left for China, they all gathered to remember the tragedy of the previous Olympic Games that is forever etched in the nation's memory. Can you talk about Munich in 1972 and its impact thereafter for that nation?
For Israel or for Germany?
For Israel, yes.
For Israel. Well, I mean, the impact was profound, not just for Israel, but for international sport. Because it was, what happened was, it was generally thought that the Palestinians who took the Israeli wrestlers hostage, which led, of course, to their deaths, that it was something that, one, could have very easily been avoided, and two, a lot of people jumped on it as if to say, you see, this is what happens when politics come to sport, as if this hadn't always been the case in sport, with politics being a part of it, particularly the Olympic Games. And unfortunately, as often happens with terrorist attacks, it also muddled exactly what the grievances were of the Palestinian people at that moment and the amount of death and destruction that they had suffered at the hands of Israel.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up about sports and politics, Dave, which is, of course, something that you're very familiar with your website, edgeofsports.com, which fuses those two issues. Yesterday, August the 10th, on NBC television, Bob Costas was interviewing George W. Bush, the president of the United States, and one of the questions that he asked him was in regards to a conversation that Bush had had with Vladimir Putin of Russia. And he asked him to comment on that, and Bush had said, well, we were talking about the whole issue of Russia and Georgia and this skirmish, and he felt that the response that Russia gave towards Georgia's incursion was overwhelming. And I found that very ironic because he would never say such a thing to, say, Shimon Peres, who was there at the Olympic Games, in regards to Israel's overwhelming response towards Palestinian resistance. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are two things to raise out of that. The first is that I thought Bush looked bothered that Bob Costas would even ask him such a question. I mean, I feel like Bush really has just turned off the light if it was ever on in the first place. I mean, he just is not interested in even thinking about this. And I keep thinking about Nero fiddling while the world burns when you see George W. Bush brushing the sand off the backsides of women's volleyball players while so much death and destruction is happening in the world. But part of the problem here is it's not just about Israel, it's about the whole war in Iraq has really set the stage for what's happening with Russia and Georgia. Because one, the U.S. after the war in Iraq has no moral authority to go after anybody for going to war in violation of the U.N. Two, they can't call upon NATO because NATO is fractured and distrustful of the United States in the wake of the war in Iraq. And three, the whole idea that the U.S. could even exercise any kind of soft power is non-existent. And then lastly, the whole reason why Russia feels bold enough to be able to do this is because it's flush with petrodollars, which it would not be if not for the U.S. war in Iraq.
You've written an article in regards to that this year marks 40 years since John Carlos and Tommy Smith made their historic protests at the Mexico Games in 1968. They were protesting against not only what was happening to black folk in the U.S., but also the conditions for blacks in South Africa under the apartheid regime. With similar events happening right now in Israel-Palestine, do you think that someone would be willing to stage a protest at these games against the treatment of the Palestinians at the hands of the Israeli government, like, say, athletes from other Middle Eastern countries?
That's an open question. It's very hard to say. I mean, as you know as good as well as anybody, historic Palestine also has a very difficult series of relationships with a lot of the nations in the Middle East as well. So it's hard to know if that's going to take place. I think if it did take place, though, it would be worthy of our solidarity and support. But I've heard no indications that at these games something like that would happen, although they might want to look to the example of the great football, that would be soccer star Abu Treka, who showed everybody his shirt, sympathized with Gaza. I mean, that would be something worth people remembering and knowing that even a small gesture, where you call even for something as, I guess, milquetoast, you might say, as sympathy, can have widespread political ramifications.
Well, it's interesting. The reason why I bring this up is recently Jordan Farmar, who is a point guard for the Los Angeles Lakers, who played in the finals this year, was in Israel holding a basketball clinic for both Israelis and Palestinians. And he had, in general, remarked that, you know, if they can come together and play, why can't we find, you know, some means of common ground for peace? So that's one of the reasons why I bring up this question. But more importantly, I want to go on to this. You've been one of the ones who's been most vocal about calling for boycotts and divestments from companies that do business with Israel and with regards to the occupation specifically. Now, it seems to me that people in general who hear about the academic boycotts as well as the economic boycotts tend to tune out about those sorts of things. But you've often emphasized that if there was a sports boycott in particular, as well as a cultural one, since dealing with the arts and those sorts of things, that that would catch on to the common person's interest a lot more. Could you talk a little bit more about that, please?
Well, sure. I mean, this goes back to the South African example and about understanding what's known as the Olympic Charter. I mean, the Olympic Charter is the statement of ideals with which the Olympics stands for. And one of those ideals is a condemnation of discrimination and war. And I think it would be something very powerful if people did what they did around the South African case, which is to say there's a gap between the Olympic ideal and how Israel is treating Gaza, how it's treating the Palestinian people. And I think that would be an important thing to point out. Now, obviously, a lot of people don't want to get involved in that sticky wicket. And but if these are the moments, as they say, that try men's souls. And I think it would be worthwhile because it would start a discussion that really does need to happen. And one in which I think, and I really do believe this, a lot of American Jews and even a lot of people who live in Israel would embrace. And that's the idea of not punishing a people just because they happen to be Palestinian.
And finally, Dave, due to the decline of the dollar against the euro, thus far 8 NBA players have left to play in Europe. One of them is Carlos Arroyo, the point guard for the Orlando Magic. I guess I should say former point guard of the Orlando Magic, and just now signed with Maccabi Tel Aviv for $2.5 million a year. Is this a sign of things to come with the continuing slide of the dollar that more NBA players might start heading over to Europe?
Yes. Yes, it is. But the real bellwether was Josh Childress, because he signed a $20 million deal. And one of the things about Josh Childress is that he is the first sort of like quote-unquote American player. I mean, Carlos Arroyo, who you mentioned, was from Puerto Rico. Others like Rudy Fernandez, I mean, these are people who are originally from Europe, from Spain. So it's less surprising. Juan Carlos Navarro, the same thing. But when you talk about somebody like Josh Childress, it really opens people's minds. And you even have people like LeBron James saying he would consider signing a two-year deal for $40 million a year, which is a crazy number, but to go play in Europe. And it's something that I'm sure is giving David Stern night sweats, and it is all rooted in the fact that $40 million, when you're talking about euros, is really only costing them, if you think about it, $25 million when you talk about the relative values of the currencies.
Our guest has been Dave Zirin, an award-winning sports writer who regularly contributes to The Nation magazine, hosts a website, edgeofsports.com, and co-hosts Edge of Sports Radio, which you can listen to on iTunes. In addition, he is the author of several books, including Welcome to the Terror Dome, The Pain, Politics, and Promise of Sports, and the forthcoming book entitled A People's History of Sports in America. Dave Zirin, as always, it's a pleasure, and thank you for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you so much.
There ain't no reason things are this way. It's how they always been and they intend to stay. I can't explain why we live this way. We do it every day. Preachers on the podium speaking of saints. Prophets on the sidewalk begging for change. Old ladies laughing from the fire escape, cursing my name. I got a basket full of lemons and they all taste the same. A window in a pigeon with a broken wing. You can spend your whole life working for something just to have it taken away. People walk around pushing back their debts.
wearing paychecks like necklaces and bracelets, talking about nothing, not thinking about death. Every little heartbeat, every little breath. People walk a tightrope on a razor's edge, carrying their hurt and hatred and weapons. It could be a bomb or a bullet or a pen, or a thought or a word or a sentence. There ain't no reason things are this way. It's how they always been and they intend to stay. I don't know why I say the things I say, but I say them anyway. But love will come, set me free. Love will come, set me free. I do believe. Love will come, set me free. I know it will. Love will come, set me free. Yes. Prison walls still standing tall. Some things never change at all. Keep on building prisons, gonna fill them all. Keep on building bombs, gonna drop them all. The wind blows wild and I may move, but politicians lie and I am not fooled. You don't need no razor nor a three-piece suit to argue the truth. The air on my skin and the world under my toes, slavery stitched to the fabric of my clothes. Chaos and commotion wherever I go, love I try to follow. Love will come, set me free. Love will come, set me free. I do believe. Love will come, set me free. I know it will. Love will come, set me free. Yes. There ain't no reason things are this way. How they always been and they intend to stay. I can't explain why we live this way. We do it every day.
Last summer, a group called the Palestine Media Collective produced a parody of the Vancouver Sun. The one-page tabloid sheet used the Vancouver Sun's name and typeface, but there were plenty of clues that it wasn't the usual local paper. The banner at the top of the front page dated the issue as Occupation Day, June 2007. In place of the usually Seriously West Coast since 1912 was Seriously Zionist since 2001, the first full year of CanWest ownership. The lead article was titled Celebrating 40 Years of Civilizing the West Bank and was written by Pirupaganda. 6 months later, Mordecai Breenberg, a well-known activist for the rights of Palestinians, was charged with producing the parody and committing a commercial violation of trademark. Last week, the Georgia Strait published an article by Gordon Murray and Carol Masevich taking full responsibility for the production of this parody. Brian Campbell is with the Seriously Free Speech Committee set up to defend Mordecai and the right to produce political parody, and he joins me in the studio this morning to talk about this most recent development and to bring us up to date on what's happening with the case. Hello, Brian.
Good morning. Hi.
Now, the article by Gordon Murray and Carol Masevich states that they've also now been named in the writ. Is this why they came forward and took responsibility?
No, in fact, they came forward on June 9th to the committee and said they were going to come forward publicly because of the list of questions that CanWest had produced for Mordecai to answer, and most of those questions involve naming people. And so they didn't want Mordecai put in the position of refusing to name names and being sent to jail or being fined, which is what would have happened because Mordecai had publicly stated he wouldn't name any names. So they came forward in response to a kind of a McCarthyite tactic of the CanWest lawyers.
So I guess once he had refused to name names, then there would be an injunction, would there, or a court order, and then he would
CanWest would conceivably go to the federal court to get an order for Mordecai to answer the questions.
And then he would be in contempt of court.
Or the court might say, you only have to answer certain questions, but yes. And then he would be in contempt of court if he didn't answer.
How did they find out that CanWest had added their names to the writ?
Well, since the writ had been issued to Mordecai already, and it was going to be a change of the writ of summons, Mordecai's lawyer was notified. And we then let them know that this was, I let them know that this was the case. And the only change that's been made to the writ has been to add Carol and Gordon's name. Everything else is left the same. So, in fact, they didn't go to the court to get their name added until July 9th.
Ken West didn't.
And they didn't receive the writ until July 22nd, just last week.
And the original writ had three Janes and three John Does, and they've just taken a couple of those out?
They've just taken one Jane and John off, and then now it's two Janes and two Johns.
Okay.
Yeah.
And have they been served a writ?
Yes, they were served the writ last week on July 22nd.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what will this mean for the suit against Mordecai, that they've now taken responsibility?
Well, first of all, they had no evidence that Mordecai did anything, and now they have people claiming that they produced it and they're solely responsible. So with any kind of conception of justice, Ken West would drop the writ from against Mordecai. But since this is really not a trademark issue but a political vendetta, we'll have to see. But it's doubtful that Ken West will drop the writ. So what that leaves with the committee is to move forward, continuing to defend Mordecai and also defending Carol and Gordon because of their right to produce political parody.
Now, as you said, you've been saying from the outset that it's a politically motivated attack on critics of Israel rather than the concern about trademark violation. What effect does this admission by Carolyn Gordon have on that view?
Well, it sharpens it. It sharpens it to the extent that if the writ against Mordecai isn't dropped, then it's really clear that it's a political vendetta. And the writ against Gordon and Carol is primarily because the parody was against the Ken West position on Israel. So it always comes back to that question of Ken West's commitment to defend Israel and their commitment to biased journalism regarding the Middle East.
To what extent have you been able to get that message, very, very important message, out into the media that this is an attack on critics of Israel and it's an attack, in a sense, on free speech?
Well, this is one of the very interesting things about this case. Ken West has a history of litigation against anybody and everybody that they disagree with, partnerships crumbling, people that have made mistakes like Rafe Mayer in Taiyi, or people that they oppose politically. And so they have really cast a chill in the Canadian media environment. So the long and short of it is, with the exception of Co-op Radio and the Georgia Strait, there's been almost no coverage, a couple of short articles in the business page in the Globe and Mail, and one radio program on Bill Good on CKNW, and various other alternate media have given it coverage, like Working TV. But none of the major media in Canada, the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, and most shocking of all, CBC, has not covered this one second. The question is, what are they worried about? Why are they scared? Why aren't they giving this very important political question coverage?
Have you been able to get coverage outside of Canada in the U.S.?
There have been announcements on various alternate media sites like ZNet, but no, not really in terms of things like Democracy Now! We haven't gotten coverage, and I think primarily because they don't realize the importance of this issue for the debates they're having in the United States around concentration of media.
It's a huge issue in the United States.
It's a huge issue in the United States, and what we are, Vancouver is the lab for the concentration of media. Here we have the most concentrated media in North America, and CanWest isn't just content with controlling the media. They are opposing people that have alternate political perspectives from which they present. So the case that they brought against Mordecai and Carol and Gordon is because they really oppose their position in opposition to the Israel occupation of Palestine. So yes, this should be a warning and a litmus test for all those people in the United States.
So in a sense, it's not just about media concentration, but it's about the desire to control the message beyond even what your newspaper is prepared to print and not print.
That's right. That's the thing that's very unique about this case, is going beyond the media control, the media you own, to try and control the message overall. They're already framing the debate in Canada, and there have been some research studies that have shown how biased the coverage is by CanWest. But they're not content with that. They're going beyond their own media.
What's the next step in the court case?
Well, we'll have an examination for discovery in September of CanWest. We'll see what comes out of that. CanWest hasn't continued the examination of discovery, which began in June. So again, with lawyers being away for the summer, both our lawyer and now their lawyer in August, the case is more or less in abeyance, but it will reactivate itself with an examination for discovery in September.
And let's just go back to the examination of discovery in Mordecai's case, because some of the questions there were really quite astounding, and I think you brought some of them in. What were some of the questions that they were asking Mordecai to respond to?
Well, what's shocking about the questions that were being asked is they weren't really around the trademark violation, nor was the writ. The questions were really casting the net among progressives and leftists and supporters of Palestine in Vancouver. So questions were, I want all the documentation relating to the Seriously Free Speech Committee, any minutes, meeting, communications, agendas, attendance, as well as members' lists, their addresses, and contact numbers. Now, the Seriously Free Speech Committee didn't even exist when the parody was produced. We didn't formulate ourselves until the spring of this year. Another question was, provide me with contact information, address, phone numbers, email, or otherwise for the individuals I listed this morning, and CanPalNet, Stop War, ISM. Produce any documentation and correspondence around the program that CanPalNet did at VPL last June.
So this
and
is asking
on and on and on for people that have been involved in things, with no evidence at all that they had participated in this parody.
So this is just generally people like the International Solidarity Movement, all those people who are involved in that, they want to know their names.
That's right. That's right. So it really looks like what they're doing is they want to get information for who knows what reason on everybody in Vancouver that's involved in supportive Palestine and in opposition to the Israeli occupation. This goes well beyond any trademark court case, and it kind of smacks not just of intimidation, but of spying on the left.
You think it would raise red flags in the United States, which suffered so heavily under McCarthyism? So not only the media ownership issue, but also the naming names and the witch hunt.
That's right. And we're beginning to see examples in the United States of major media going after alternate media when they counter them, when they present alternative things on their websites and on their radio programs. So this, what we're seeing in Vancouver with CanWest, looks like it's a trend that's beginning, and it's in the United States now as well.
What's the next step for the committee now?
Well, we're going to continue trying to get media coverage of this issue, but we're also going to start meeting with individuals and organizations. And we would ask your listeners, any that are interested in having a small meeting in their house to meet with Mordecai or Gordon or Carol or other members of the committee, we would encourage them to do that. We need to get the word out more broadly. Since we can't count on the media, The corporate media were going to have to go out through community organizations, individuals, unions, student societies, that kind of thing. So that's how we'll be spending our time.
And they can contact you through the website.
And they can contact us through the website.
Thank you very much, Brian.
And the website is www.seriouslyfreespeech.ca.
Yes, I didn't say it because I was going to say it in a moment, but now we will say it twice, which okay. is better.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Brian Campbell. He's co-chair of the Seriously Free Speech Committee, and as he said, you can go to their website, seriouslyfreespeech.com.
In Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. Three Palestinians who won prestigious scholarships to study in the United States had their American entry visas revoked after, quote, new information was received about them. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice had previously championed efforts by the three Fulbright scholars, who are residents of the Gaza Strip, to secure exit permits from Israel, which maintains a tight blockade on the Hamas-controlled territory. An official at the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem said, quote, we discovered new information that led us to revoke these visas prudentially. The three scholars, Zuhair Abu Shaban, Fida Abed, and Osama Daoud, received visas after being interviewed and fingerprinted by the U.S. consular officials in July at Eretz checkpoint. The three were among seven Gazans awarded Fulbright scholarships this year. The U.S. government at first withdrew them because Israel did not grant the Palestinians exit permits. Following media reports on the case, the Fulbrights were restored and the United States formally asked Israel to allow the scholars to leave Gaza. Israel let four of the seven students travel to the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem for visa interviews, but citing security needs, denied permits to Shaban, Abed, and Daoud. With us to speak more on this issue is Crossing the Line's good friend Anna Balzer, a former Fulbright scholar, activist, and author of the book, Witness in Palestine, A Jewish-American Woman in the Occupied Territories. Anna, welcome back to Crossing the Line.
Thanks so much for having me, Najee.
Anna, can you talk briefly about the opportunities that a Fulbright scholarship brings, and more importantly, just how competitive it is to be awarded one of these scholarships?
Well, when I applied for my scholarship, it was a very long and competitive process, but that doesn't even compare to the process of a non-American applying for a Fulbright to actually go into the U.S., and it's a long process. It spans about a year, almost a year, and is a pretty big deal. It's an incredible opportunity. It's a nice deal all around. It's a way for people to be able to focus on academics without having, for once, to worry about earning a living because it's provided by the fund itself. And it's frankly really shocking that that Israel has been able to pull off basically revoking the grants given to these Palestinians who earned them.
At first, Israel denied the exit visas to the students, and after constant media coverage and U.S. intervention, Israel relented. Now the U.S. has denied their visas to enter regarding this new information from the consular in Jerusalem. Do you feel that this new information was basically more of a backhanded way of saying you're embarrassing us by Condoleezza Rice making the statements that these students deserve academic opportunities, even though they are from the Gaza Strip, as opposed to, like, say, the West Bank, where they have a better chance of getting out? Or do you feel that there's something else going on here?
Yeah, I mean, it's shocking to me. I tend to not buy into the idea that somehow Israel is controlling the U.S., although clearly the Zionist lobby is able to sway oftentimes U.S. policy. I think what's happening is what's consistent with what's been happening for a very long time, which is that Israel, for quote-unquote security reasons, is able to do pretty much whatever it wants. And, you know, the security reasons that were given to the U.S., to U.S. officials, whatever they might have been, of course, they're not shared with anybody else. They're not necessarily legitimized with any actual foundation of reality. And this is the way that Israel operates and has been allowed to operate given given our policies of unconditional support. So it's kind of not a surprise. It's a shock in that it's a particularly, and this is probably a good thing that it's gotten a lot of media attention and that it's a very prestigious thing that is being denied these Gazans, but it's somehow not surprising given that this is part of Israeli policy. And you know, it's interesting the way that Israel, of course, talks about Palestinians not using their resources, that it's Palestinians' fault, that let's say the roads aren't as good in the West Bank as they are in Israel or what have you, when in actual fact it is Israel that systematically targets any kind of Palestinian infrastructure, be it roads or a police force or education. And that's a big part of the occupation, is to break down any kind of civil society that would help to build resistance to Israeli colonization and control over the land and the resources. So what we see here is just another example. You know, some examples would be people being denied access to their schools by checkpoints or by the wall, and here we have by quote-unquote security reasons that are presumably unfounded, if it's anything like the others that I've experienced. So, and in this sense, we really see the way that Palestinian education is a kind of resistance to Israel's efforts, and the fact that Palestinians, in spite of not being able to leave Gaza in order to be interviewed or in order to get a visa or in order to actually use their fellowship, how education in Gaza, in the West Bank, in historic Palestine, everywhere of Palestinians is a kind of resistance. And what's very interesting, I think, is that, you know, Israel, a lot of Israel's policies, I really think, underneath are aimed at encouraging Palestinians to leave. So one might ask sort of, well, why not just make it really easy for Palestinians to leave? Because, of course, the underlying issue with Israel's existence is that in order to maintain a Jewish state in a land where the majority with rights to it aren't Jewish, you have to systematically pressure people to leave and ensure that they do. So why would Israel try and prevent these people from leaving? And I think the answer lies in if the people are leaving to leave, period, that's one thing. If people are leaving with the intention of coming back and building up Palestinian society, then that becomes a threat to Israel's domination, and we see things like this happening.
In spite of all that's going on with this Fulbright scholarship, with this whole issue, as you say, of leaving and returning or leaving permanently, one of the central things that is being missed when it's brought up within the mainstream media in regards to this issue is that constantly Israel claims to be the only democracy within the Middle East. And this is what they tout all along, that they say that they are the ones who are the most even-handed and most realistic. But as you said, within this whole issue, exclusively only with education, not to mention a host of other issues, they are really being very uneven-handed.
Absolutely. And that's the way it has to be in order to maintain Israel the way that it is. In other words, the denial of rights and the discrimination against Palestinians is required in order to maintain a Jewish majority. So you know, you take a place where the majority is non-Jewish and you say, well, we want to create a Jewish majority. You have to discriminate. And so there we find that the issue is not that Israel has sort of is manifesting a perversion of the enlightenedness that it could be, but that inherent in a Jewish state is this anti-democratic discrimination. And that's an important thing, I think, to realize. And sort of Israeli apologists may find whatever excuses that they do, but you cannot maintain an artificial Jewish majority. That is an inorganic one, one that was imposed and is maintained by discriminating other people. You can't maintain that and not do what Israel's doing. So in order to really sort of explore ways of changing things, we really have to look at that concept of an ethnocentric nationalist state that does not leave room for the other.
And what about the opportunity for these students to have these scholarships? Can they retroactively receive these Fulbright scholarships next year, or would they have to reapply all over again?
According to the article that I read, I think it was in the New York Times, they would have to reapply, which is, of course, a very long process beginning almost now because it does take a full year. And the chances of getting it for anybody are pretty slim because it is very competitive.
And finally, Anna, there are mounting calls for academic boycotts and sanctions to be placed on Israeli educational institutions. With the denial of these scholarships and the imprisoning of so many other students within Gaza who have no opportunities as well to go abroad when they've received scholarships to study, is it more important than ever now, do you feel, to demand that these boycotts of academic institutions of Israel be in place?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, this is precisely the time when we would expect academic institutions in Israel and elsewhere to speak out. You know, one of the arguments used against the academic boycott is that somehow it will stifle precisely the debate and outrage within Israel that exists against what the government is doing. But what we find in actual fact is that unlike in many other countries, Israeli universities are not the sort of beacons of progressive thought that we expect them to be. And in these kinds of cases, this is specifically regarding academia, and we don't see Israeli universities really speaking out. And this just shows that it is time. It has been time for a very long time. And the boycott should not simply be of, you know, Israeli oranges or U.S. companies profiting off of the occupation, but any institution that has not publicly come out against the Israeli government's policies until Israel complies with international law.
Our guest today has been our good friend Anna Balzer, a former Fulbright scholar, activist, author of the book Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American Woman in the Occupied Territories, and hosts a website, AnnaInTheMiddleEast.com, which, of course, you can find a link to on our site. Anna, as always, it's a pleasure, and thank you again for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you again for having me, Naji.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios of 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer George Rishmawi, segment producer Ali Budner, contributing producers Mumia Abu-Jamal, Ramiya Magari, Scott Berguin, Quiva Butterly, and Nora Barrows-Friedman. From all of us here, we thank you so much for your continued support. In Berkeley, this is Naji Ali for Crossing the Line. Signing off.